You're in the middle of nowhere, with the day fading to a pale band on the horizon. From the descending dark, a bus pulls up, brightly lit inside, but with no name, no destination. The door shuttles open before you. There is no driver. Do you climb aboard? Of course you do. It's why you're here. Welcome to the Gray Line. Tonight's journey will take us on an unfathomable trajectory to the very outer limits of earthly space, 255 miles above the spinning blue marble that most of us call home. Most of us except for the woman seated just ahead, her brow pressed to the window glass, staring out into the rushing dark, unblinking, unable to stop looking for what she knows she'll never find. You may join her in her search, but she'll never know you're there, never hear your voice, or feel your cautious touch. For her, you and I, only exist across the impossible chasm between desperate hope and the gray line.
The 7 billion people who call Earth home were right there, framed in the jewel of the oval-shaped window. I could see none of them and all of them. "What day is it?" I asked, not taking my eyes from the window.
"September the 7th,"
Finn answered smoothly. Everything he said was smooth. His voice was like amber whiskey on rocks of ice. "Summer's ending," I sighed. It was an inconsequential comment. It was always winter in space, always night, though not always cold. It surprised people to learn that. When the sun shines in space, it can be blisteringly hot. That's why the spacesuits are white. The winter of space isn't a chill of cold, just of dark emptiness. I didn't feel alone, though. 7 billion people were just outside my window. I pushed away, turned back to my work. "So what's for lunch?"
"What's for dinner, you mean?"
Finn answered.
"It's almost 18:30. I was thinking chicken curry."
I shook my head to myself, blew a breath up into my bangs, kicked off, and returned to the hydroponics pod like a dolphin slipping effortlessly through water. 4 hours later, I sank toward sleep, belted into the upright bunk, my hair floating in a corona around my face. As Finn dimmed the lights, the stars beyond the window no longer felt like night. Starlight hadn't meant night to me since my last daytime cycle on the big blue marble below. 2 years ago now. The bunk across from me was crisply folded up, its sheets tucked in, its straps cinched tight over nothing. I looked at the bunk without seeing it. The air warmed a little as Finn adjusted the environmental settings. The air pressure lessened, the humidity level increased. I felt it in my sinuses and the back of my eyes. I slept. I woke. Nothing was changed. Well, something had changed. The hydroponic beds were different. Same plants, same stage of growth, but there was something odd about them. The tomato plant had had 3 budding orange-red bulbs on it. Now it had 2. I looked around for the third, swept my gaze around the pod, then stopped and allowed my eyes to unfocus a bit. It was a trick that Hazim had taught me.
"Not on the ground anymore,"
he said when I'd lost a stylus my first week on the station.
"It didn't roll into a corner or under a sofa. It's floating. Don't look at anything specific. Just take in the hole and wait for movement."
I'd found the stylus that way. It'd been drifting over the treadmill, turning as slowly as a minute hand on a clock, pinpricks of light sliding along its metal length like spectral ants. But I didn't find the tomato.
"It probably fell off and got pulled into the intake vent,"
Finn said, observing me.
"I hope not, though. Could smell the place up a bit when it starts going bad."
I shrugged. Worse smells in the world than a rotten tomato. I'd grown up in the country, Ohio in fact, just like John Glenn and loads of other space jockeys. The Heartland just seems to grow adventurers. Or maybe it just grows people who want to get as far away from Ohio as possible. But the tomato bugged me. I kept glancing around for it, knowing I'd find it eventually. Or maybe not. I'd never found Hazim, after all. That had been almost 16 months earlier, when the comms had first gone down. The antenna had been stuck by some of the 15,000 bits of space junk orbiting the planet. Tiny pieces of random flotsam, but at 22,000 miles an hour, a tiny piece is all it takes. The blue earth, visible right outside the window, had gone deaf and dumb. Hazim suited up and cycled through the airlock, his tether locked on and double-checked. It was an easy repair, he radioed in to me.
It's an easy repair.
But then I heard the sharp impacts of more space junk. The sound like the pop and fizzle of fireworks as the objects hit the solar tiles and pulverized into glitter, and a burst of static broke the connection. I reeled in Hazim's tether and could tell by the limpness of it what I'd find. Hazim was gone. The tether was severed clean, sharp and neat, as if it had been cut with a cleaver. I never saw Hazim outside the 3-inch plexi windows. I tried not to think about him. Just one more piece of space debris. 15,001. Finn didn't know how to console me, but he offered his own reassurances.
The return deployment system is fully automated. When the mission scope is complete, it'll go online and take you home. I'll keep you company until then.
And who will keep you company when I'm gone? I asked, probably telegraphing my own sudden, seemingly bottomless loneliness.
I'm a simulated personality,
Finn replied smoothly, almost with a smile in his bloodless, everywhere voice.
I'll just go offline until the next crew arrives.
I gave up on the tomato. I ran on the treadmill, belted into the resistance tensions. I listened to some music. Dinner that night was chickpeas and coconut rice. Finn was going through a Thai kick. I slept. I awoke. Two tomatoes. At least, that was all right. There was a library on the computer. I read a lot. I listened to audiobooks when I ran on the treadmill or used the resistance weights, working to keep my joints strong and my spine from shrinking in the forgiving weightlessness. Something had been wrong with the library for a few weeks. It kept forgetting my place in a book, starting all over again from the beginning. Today, when I pulled up the reading app, my favorites were missing. Where are my books? Finn made a thinking sound, a descending bass tone.
I'll have to do some work. I can't seem to find some parts of your profile. Maybe we're running out of available memory. Would you mind if I used some of Hazim's?
Hazim had been on the station for a year before I arrived, and he loved movies. He had terabytes of them, stuff dating all the way back to the early 2000s. I slumped a little. I guess you might as well.
He'd want you to use it,
Finn soothed. Tears pricked my eyes, surprising me. It wasn't just the convincing sincerity of Finn's tone. I was surprised that grief could still sneak up on me like that. I'd invented a term for moments like this. I called it death lag. Just when I thought I was past it, when I was over the pangs of that tidy, empty bunk, something would bring it right back again, cheerfully reminding me that Hazim was dead. And I was alone. Alone, except for the familiar blue orb just outside my window. I slept. I awoke. Days blended on and on. Nothing changed. Except that things did. Little by little, almost imperceptibly. What day is it? I asked, looking up from the computer monitor at nothing.
It's March 1st.
I ran the numbers in my head. Only a few more months, I mused wistfully. 56 days.
As you say,
Finn agreed.
What do you think they're all doing down there?
I smiled and glanced back toward the window. In my neck of the woods, it's just now turning into spring. The snow is finally all melted, but there's mud everywhere. The fields are still bare, plowed into corduroy. The air smells like wet sweat socks and basement floor.
Sounds nice,
Finn said. Yeah, I said, still smiling, not at all ironic. The computer was acting wonky. I was trying to fix it myself, defragmenting it, considering a clean system reboot, starting from the original image. It was a little risky, but Finn would help. Finn ran on a separate system, with his own memory and backups. He said he'd talk me through it if it became necessary. The funny thing was the computer didn't act like it was running out of memory. It acted like it was breaking down, getting slow and old, like a much older system. Its memory clogged and chugging with strain. But that was impossible, of course. The system had just gotten its latest software update a few days before the comms died. The hydroponics grew, but there was something off about them as well. The plants were always changing in weird, indefinable ways. I couldn't put my finger on it. It was in the leaf arrangements, the spacing between the root balls, even the way the branches intertwined from day to day. It almost looked like someone came along every night and rummaged around in them, mussing them up, making them unfamiliar. The thought gave me a deep chill, not because I was afraid of the idea, but because it gave me a pang of almost aching desire. I found myself unfocusing when I ran on the treadmill, allowing my eyes to take in the whole of the pod, hoping for movement, for an errant shift, the tiniest budge of a shadow. It never came. I slept. I awoke. The intake vent nearest the head developed a rattle. It was faint, a mere buzz in its seams. I took it apart and was surprised to see a veil of rust on the inside of the gasket. The rust wasn't from the gasket itself, which was made of titanium, but from the screws.
Probably the humidity differentials between day and night cycles,
Finn said. I nodded. Finn couldn't lie. That was just one of the inviolate axioms of his programming. We'd all read our Asimov. The days of the mission cycle dwindled away, and yet I felt no anticipation. No hope swelled as the weeks bled away. I felt old, like the station itself around me, strangely old, as if space had its own way of marking ages. I think part of me knew all along. You see that, right? The truth lurked at the edges of my vision, not unlike the phantom somebody that I kept hoping might appear. I was taking in the whole, just like Hazim had taught me. I just wasn't consciously aware of it yet. I slept. I awoke. The time bled away, and finally, with no fanfare, the mission cycle ended. I signed off all my logs, closed down the hydroponics pod after lunching on the last of my tomatoes and peas, and changed into my flight suit. I stared at the helmet clamped to the wall. I could see my own reflection in it, my long black hair floating out in streamers. In the curves of the polarized glass, I looked too thin, too pale. My face was unlined and smooth, as always, but there was darkness beneath my eyes and in the hollows of my cheeks. I'm not going home, I said to Finn. Am I? Finn always answered immediately, but this time he did not. The silence of the station wasn't true silence. It was a low hum, a cycle of whispers, distant clicks and burrs of machinery. I had long since stopped hearing them. Now, in Finn's silence, I tuned into them anew, because I knew the truth. I was nowhere near done hearing them. Finn, you can't lie.
I never lied,
Finn answered smoothly. I asked you the dates.
You asked me what day it was,
Finn agreed.
You never asked me the year.
I nodded. It seemed to take all my strength. I watched my reflection mimic the action in the mirror of my helmet. It was like watching a woman embedded in amber. I swallowed. How long has it been?
The first international chemical attacks began on January the 11th, 2032. I'm afraid that, on that date, mutually assured destruction changed from a sobering warning to an inevitability. I observed the transmissions, didn't wish to worry you or Hazim with them, so I turned off the comms.
A coldness that had nothing to do with the dark of space seemed to fill the pod. I felt myself slowly drowning in it, and still my eyes met my own gaze, tiny in the blank orb of the helmet. And Hazim?
I did not harm him,
Finn answered immediately, his smooth voice speaking the words as carefully as a surgeon uses a scalpel.
I cannot lie, nor can I cause or allow harm. He was struck by a shower of debris. It punctured his left lung and shoulder. I turned off his comm and severed his tether to spare you the shock.
I nodded again. I felt no anger, just coldness. It seeped into me from the chill all around. How long has it been? I asked again.
I don't actually believe that everyone on Earth is dead,
Finn said, still speaking with exquisite care.
There are still flickers of life, but they're no longer civilized, or well, exactly. The sickness is terrible. It will still be some time before it's safe and they are ready for you, whoever might be left. I'm preserving you for them.
The station was equipped with a biosuspension system, I remembered, in case it was ever used for interplanetary travel. Mars was always on the table, according to the visionaries at NASA, but nothing had really been in the works when I left. It was still just a persistent idea, decades away, despite the readiness of the technology. Did you biosuspend me? I asked, keeping my voice level.
I did.
How often?
Every night.
The chill reached my shoulders now, racked them with a deep shudder. I tried to speak again, couldn't, and swallowed. Finn asked,
Would you like some water?
How long?
Every night for the past 20 months, for 2 years each cycle.
My mouth opened again, but no sound came out. I stared at nothing. I was seeing the hole now, and only in that context did I recognize the movements that I'd been missing all along. Finn let the hydroponics die every time I went to sleep. Then, 20 months later, he replanted them and allowed them to grow back to the same point before waking me up. He did this. I blinked rapidly as I did the math in my head. He did this for 1,200 years. I sank to the floor. Only I didn't. I simply went limp and floated, drawing my legs up, letting my arms float up, feeling my hair curl around my face like seaweed in a slow current. Finn dimmed the lights thoughtfully. The only light now came from the window across from me. The big blue marble was illuminated on one side, dark on the other. No longer 7 billion people. How many? Were there any left down there at all? Perhaps someday I would find out. I had to hope that I would, that Finn was right, that there were still people down there, perhaps sick, perhaps barely clinging to the bones of existence, but still there, waiting for me, without knowing it. Or perhaps someday I would be an old, old woman. My black hair bled white every night, an eon, staring out at a skeletal world, 1 billion years older than it had been when I left it. But I wouldn't be alone. Oh no, never truly alone. Finn told me so. And Finn never, ever lied.
Thank you.
And that, faithful traveler, as always, brings us to tonight's final destination. Be sure to collect your luggage, should you have any, and please mind the closing doors. Thank you for traveling with us, and do remember, not every journey ends so conveniently. The next time you board with us, you may find yourself lost forever. Just one more tale told on the forgotten highways of the Grey Line. The Grey Line is produced by me, G. Norman Lippert. Deathlag featured the voice talent of Jeannie Lynn as the lone survivor, Just Sargent as Finn, and G. Norman Lippert as Hazim. Today's episode featured music by Kevin MacLeod, licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution license. Subscribe to The Grey Line for regular stories from the forgotten highways of the beyond. And do consider leaving a rating or review, as they are the number one way that podcasts like this find new audiences. And check out my novels, including my newest, The Nightmare Pearl, available in print, ebook, and audio format.